latest news. It's time once again for Engaging Your World. Here's your host, Tom Krause.
Welcome to Engaging Your World. This is Tom Krause, your host. Great to have you along with us. Set off for another week of live call-in talk radio. And as always, we are honored that you would join us and honored to be a part of your day, that you would take time out of your day. It's a privilege. And we got a great week of shows lined up, and we can talk about a lot of things, but particularly quickly, Helen Thomas, that longtime reporter, that longtime, I guess we call it reporter, journalist, just says the amazingly crazy things at times, and did it once again, talking about the Jews need to be all sent to Poland or whatever she said. Well, she's going to retire. She's had it. The jig is up. The news is out. We finally found it. The renegade who had it made. So, done. She's done. And about time. All we can say is it's about time. So that's done. There's this, by the way, we're going to have an author on talk about who killed John F. Kennedy. Kind of an interesting way this guy did this in his book. It's called Kennedy Must Be Killed. And he writes it as a fictional thing with a lot of historical facts. So it's always interesting to talk about Kennedy and that. It's one of those fascinating things that people like. People just like to talk about it. But close to us in Bloomfield, Connecticut, don't know if you've been following this or not, Connecticut School District had a showdown with the ACLU and of course, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And that's come to an end at least for a year with the clock ticking. The Enfield School Board voted 5-4 this past Thursday night not to appeal a preliminary injunction by U.S. District Judge Janet Hall, who ruled last Monday that it was unconstitutional for the District 2 high schools to hold their commencement ceremonies at a church. First Cathedral in Bloomfield, Connecticut, it's a mega church kind of thing, big deal, a lot of room. And two high schools are going to have the graduation there. And, of course, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, ACLU, all started just whining, crying, stomping their feet. It goes against church and state. It goes against church. So they got it done, though, didn't they? They got it done. And so the graduations will not be held there. And that's it's actually surprising that it went this way. It's not surprising they had all the hullabaloo about it, but it's surprising that it went this way. And Vin McCarthy, attorney with American Center for Law and Justice, said, "I was shocked and I was stunned. I thought the decision was pro forma. I thought we had a good chance." The school board chairman was also surprised. They thought it would be fine, but the high school graduations will not be held at First Cathedral in Bloomfield, Connecticut, because theoretically it violates the theoretical separation of church and state, which, again, is all smoke and mirrors and not what everybody thinks it is. But, you know, it's not good. And Enfield was one of the five school districts that was planning to have commencement ceremonies there because they have state-of-the-art facilities. They have a huge field, ample parking. It just made sense. No one's going to have a church service. They're going to have a graduation. But, oh, God forbid it be on the grounds of a church. All right, coming back. Great show lineup. Glad you're with us. We'll see you in about, I don't know, 2 minutes.
Bethel Seminary of the East, it's not just for pastors. Hi, I'm Noel Sherry, the New England Center Director. Join me at our Auburn campus. Sit in on a class, meet faculty and students. Get your questions answered, and you'll find out how men and women are discerning and responding to God's call. Call me, Noel Sherry, directly at 508-272-7422 to arrange a time on a Thursday, May 20th or 27th, June 3rd or 10th. Call 508-272-7422.
The Not For Sale campaign presents SoulFest 2010, New England's premier Christian music festival, August 4th through the 7th. Join us for 4 days and nights of music and teaching featuring Mercy Me.
And all of creation, sing with me now.
Switchfoot.
This is home. This is home. Yeah, this is home.
Toby Mac.
A city on a
Cutlass.
That's what
Stars of Clay, Israel Hote, Marlowe Girl, Matthew West, Super Chick, Hawk Nelson, Sanctus Rio, Phil Joel, Matt Marr, over 75 acclaimed artists and speakers. Located at the beautiful Gunstock Mountain Resort in Guilford, New Hampshire, Soulfest 2010 could be the highlight of your summer. Don't miss this life-changing time of worship, fellowship, and celebration. For special discounts for you and your family, visit thesoulfest.com or call 978-346-4577.
Save hundreds, even thousands of dollars on superior quality previously owned furniture at Furniture Plus of Worcester, also specializing in stripping and refinishing in upholstery. They're online at FurnituresPlusRepair.com, and they encourage you to listen to Renewing Your Mind with R.C. Sproul weekdays at 4 here on WVNE.
All right, welcome back to the show. And you know, some things you just don't forget. Where you were when things happened. Elvis died, Marilyn Monroe died, 9/11, space shuttle blew up in the air, and of course, John Kennedy was killed. And there's been so much written about this, you would think, well, what else could be written about it? But that's what we're going to talk about. Chuck Helpe is a person who's written a fictional book based on historical fact. He reviewed over 125,000 pages of material, and his father worked for Attorney General Robert Kennedy as an economist in the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department. John Glenn lived down the street from him, so there's some connections here. And, of course, former President Kennedy's birthday was May 29th, so it's kind of all revolves around that as well. So the book is called Kennedy Must Be Killed, and the author, Chuck Helpe, is with us. Chuck, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Tom. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. So I guess the first question would be, why another book about John F. Kennedy?
Well, that's a good question in and of itself. There have been over 2,000 books written about the assassination from a nonfiction standpoint, but just a handful written from a fiction standpoint or novel standpoint. And I thought there was room for me to kind of elaborate on some of the causes and effects that you could do in a novel form that you really can't do in nonfiction. And I think that's what makes the book so unique.
And how did you come to decide? Because it's as far as I can tell, the first one, there might be others, but the only one I could find that was done the way you did it as far as writing a fictional book, trying to get across some historical facts. How'd you come up with that idea?
It really came about as a result of some of the same research. I once found a quote by Gaetan Fonzi, who was a former investigator for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And he once wrote that what he felt was needed to solve the assassination was a meta-analysis of the clandestine social, political, military, and global forces at work at mid-century as they converged upon Dealey Plaza. And he went on to say, if you can understand the state of the world, America, and the South as it truly was on November 21st, 1963, then the events of November 22nd fall into place as neatly as the pieces of a puzzle. So my novel explores the social and cultural underpinnings that led to the assassination of our president, the ever-advancing threat of communism, the growing power of the CIA, the heated tumult of the civil rights movement, the clandestine influence of the mafia, the escalation of the Cold War through numerous national security blunders by the Kennedy administration, as well as the reckless personal behavior of John F. Kennedy himself.
We're talking with Chuck Helpe, the author of Kennedy Must Be Killed, a fictional book with some historical underpinnings. Now, your dad worked for Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Do you remember anything from back then?
Oh, I remember a lot. Even though I was a young man at the time, I remember going to attend John F. Kennedy's inauguration and standing on the lawn of the Capitol to hear his famous inaugural speech. And then I also remember a few years later standing on Constitution Avenue with millions of other Americans waiting for the funeral cortege to come by. And at the time, somebody yelled out, oh, my God, Oswald's been shot. And somebody standing very close to us said, now we'll never know what happened. And that stuck with me my entire life, that quest to find out what really did happen on that horrible day.
What did your dad weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, he did. We had lots of discussions about that early on. The evening of the assassination, living in Arlington, we went out and started trying to buy every paper we could find that would give us some news about what had happened in Dallas earlier that day. And we pretty much kept up to breast on every newspaper article and magazine article that came out over the course of the next year, culminating in the release of the Warren Commission report in September of '64. And I actually told my dad that the day the report was to come out, please go over to the government printing office and pick up one of the first copies as they come off the presses. And he did that and brought it home that night when he returned for dinner. And we kind of had a little argument over who was going to read it first. He, of course, won. But from that point on, I've been busy researching the assassination on my own.
Just that description alone tells you how different the times were, that the fact you'd go out and have to buy up every paper and magazine to try to figure out what happened, as opposed to the internet age we're in today. So, Chuck, how different do you think things would have been if that had happened in a time when there was technology as we have it, internet, and you know, the way news media is run today?
It would have been massively different, Tom. The media at the time, as you recall, was a media that was, we thought, very open and honest with the American people, as we thought the government was. And I think the internet today does a much better job of enabling a lot of people to exchange ideas and information that otherwise doesn't get published in that major media. A good example is just the JFK research community. This is a dedicated bunch of people around the world that have been chasing down facts and chasing down data and interviewing people decades after what transpired in Dallas, and they're still uncovering new information and debating it today. I think that if that had been available back in 1963, we wouldn't have had all these years of question marks and debate over what really did occur.
We're talking with Chuck Helpe. The book is Kennedy Must Be Killed. It's a fictional novel, historical novel. All right, so give our listeners kind of the outline of the book, what you're trying to do there, what happens with it.
Yeah, it really starts out as the story of how an idealistic and patriotic young American went to post-World War II Washington, D.C., and how 16 years later became the long-rumored gunman on the grassy knoll in Dallas. We trace the start of Patrick McCarthy's career. Patrick is my hero or protagonist, as he arrives in Washington, determined to try to repay the greatest generation's sacrifices from World War II. He had been too young to serve in the war, but wanted to do something, at least on a patriotic level, to help serve his country. So he ends up in Washington in 1946 as a young congressional aide, and through his position on Capitol Hill in a very minor role, begins to meet not only his roommates, Grant Grantham, the son of a powerful Texas Wildcatter, but also a man who works on Lyndon Johnson's payroll, and Chase Newman, his other roommate, who happened to be a newspaper man in Washington, a little bit older than Grant and Patrick, but who also went to school in Massachusetts with John Kennedy. So those three men begin to grow up in Washington, D.C., and they encounter a number of other famous personages, such as Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover, Alan Dulles, and it begins to kind of shape their life as their careers begin to advance through the 1950s.
What's been the response to your book? What are people saying that are reading it?
Response has been pretty terrific, Tom. I think people find it thought-provoking. It's a very complex book in some ways because it can be read on a number of different levels. You can read it just for the pure enjoyment of the novel, but it's also very educational. There's a lot of historical fact that's been woven in and out throughout the book and throughout the plot that people can go back and research on their own. I've included my entire bibliography on the website, KennedyMustBeKilled.com. So it gives the reader a chance to read a chapter and go back and do some research on that chapter if they so wish. And they're finding that it's entertaining, funny, and kind of shocking at times as well. So the response so far has been overwhelmingly positive.
Why do you think people, so many people, accepted the Warren Commission report? I just mean common, everyday people. I mean, how was that put over as well as it was?
I think it was because back in 1964, we were a much different country. We didn't believe that the government was capable of lying to us. And so whatever we were told by the government, we accepted at face value. And it wasn't until we began to encounter the problems with the Vietnam War, the release of the Pentagon Papers, the shattering effect of Watergate and the president's cover-up there, that we all began to realize that there may be other things going on in Washington that we were either naive or ignorant of. And as we begin to look back on what has transpired since, I think that sense of unease about did we really learn what was going on or were we told a different story continues to hold true to this day. Very early in my book, I talk about the fact that on November 22nd of 1963, President John F. Kennedy was shot and killed on the streets of Dallas, Texas, and that's not disputed. On September 24th of 1964, the United States government in the Warren Commission emphatically pronounced Lee Harvey Oswald to be the lone gunman with no evidence of a conspiracy in the president's murder. And they stated very clearly, on the basis of the evidence before the commission, it concludes that Oswald acted alone. But then 15 years later, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, after their investigation, threw the Warren Commission under the bus and essentially said, on the basis of the evidence now available to it, President John F. Kennedy was probably assassinated as the result of a conspiracy. The committee, however, is unable to identify the other gunman or the extent of that conspiracy. And so, to this day, there's a fairly large debate and a large question mark in the minds of many Americans, just what did the president really do, referring to Johnson, that may have facilitated in a possible cover-up of the events in Dallas on November 22nd of 63.
The book is Kennedy Must Be Killed. Excuse me, the author, Chuck Helpy, is with us. And all right, so let's put – how old are you, Chuck?
I'm 58.
All right, so you're 58. Let's put you at 88 and pretend your mind is still working very well and you're there with your grandkids and you're going to die in a couple of days. And they say, all right, Grandpa, tell us what happened. What happened when Kennedy got assassinated? What would your answer be?
I would begin to tell them a story about the concern that the country had back in the 40s and 50s about a repeat of Pearl Harbor, but this time on a nuclear basis, that the rise of communism after World War II and the rise of nuclear power presented the leaders of our country with some horrifying scenarios that they wanted to work really hard to make sure that this country was protected from. And as we saw General Dwight D. Eisenhower become president in the 50s and work very, very hard to protect the nation, we elected a very young and inexperienced president in 1960 who proceeded to not only dismantle some of that Eisenhower security apparatus, but made a series of critical blunders in his first year and a half in office.
Sounds familiar.
That may have contributed to a great fear in the minds of powerful men that his next blunder could result in millions of Americans being killed. And I think that there was a decision made to try to stop that before it actually happened.
By who? So basically what you're saying is the decision was made to kill the president. Who made that decision?
As I talk about it in the book, I think it was a group of shadowy men that I refer to as the Patriots. They were people that were kind of behind the scenes in the government, in business, and in the military that were very, very concerned about some of the mistakes that John F. Kennedy was making. And just to kind of elaborate on those, we could start with the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. That invasion had been very carefully plotted and planned by the Eisenhower administration and by the CIA. And those completed invasion plans were essentially handed over to John Kennedy when he assumed office in January of 61. But John pretty quickly decided that maybe he could fix those plans up a little bit better than everyone else. So he began to kind of meddle in the planning and move the invasion site 80 miles from where it was supposed to be into what we now know as the Bay of Pigs, which was a swampy area in Cuba. He ruled out military support by the United States. He changed some of the aspects of the invasion so dramatically that the invasion was almost destined to fail from the time it began. And then he withheld any additional support that might have enabled some remnants of that invasion force to at least escape rather than be captured by Fidel Castro. The military took that as a very, very strong rebuke to their own power and judgment. And that kind of alerted them to the fact that maybe John was going to be a problem. A couple months later, he went to the Vienna summit in May of 61 with Premier Khrushchev, and literally went in unprepared for that summit. He thought he could charm Khrushchev. Well, Khrushchev wasn't capable of being charmed. He was a very hard-nosed veteran of World War II and quickly decided that he could push Kennedy around, which he proceeded to do not only in the summit, but in the aftermath of the summit, which led to the Berlin Wall crisis in 61, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. As my research also showed, there was a lot of rumors going around in Washington at the time about the military possibly moving against the president. Tom, many of your listeners might remember the book 7 Days in May, which was turned into a pretty terrific movie with Gregory Peck, or Burt Lancaster. And it was a fictional story, but it was written by a couple of Washington reporters who were covering the rumors of the time. And one of the strong rumors was that the military might very well try to take over the White House. Kennedy knew those rumors. He talked about them with his brother. There's historical record concerning some of those conversations. And he and Bobby were very concerned that his enemies might try to move against him. There's one very famous conversation that Jack had with Red Fay, in which he's talking to Red about the trouble that a young president could be in if he had to
identify Red Fay so people know who they.
Red Fay was a close confidant of JFK. I think he was also one of the crew members of PT-109, and he was kind of one of those guys that Jack brought with him throughout his service in government. Red at the time, I think, was the assistant undersecretary to the Navy. But they were very, very good friends, had been friends for decades. And Red Fay listened rather emotionally when Jack was talking about how a young president could have one Bay of Pigs and possibly get away with it, but a second Bay of Pigs would certainly cause a lot of concern in the minds of powerful people. And if there was a third Bay of Pigs, he says that president probably couldn't survive that. And he says, but that's not going to happen to me. That will not happen on my watch. Well, as I show in the book, I think he was probably dealing with at least four of those Bay of Pigs events, and that may have led to his removal.
By who?
By a group of, I think, powerful men in the military, rogue elements of our own intelligence agency, and politicians and people involved with organized crime and politics in Texas.
Talk with Chuck Helpe. The book is Kennedy Must Be Killed. Does the word James Files mean anything to you?
James Files is in prison, I think, in Illinois. He supposedly has confessed to being the gunman on the grassy knoll.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because I have some correspondence from him that is kind of interesting. So some theories are that it was the CIA because Kennedy was going to do away with the CIA. I'm trying to think of the man, you might know his name, he was involved in Watergate as well. Was it Haldeman or Ehrlichman that was involved with the CIA back then?
Howard Hunt.
Oh, Howard Hunt, okay. And supposedly, I had talked with his son, Howard Hunt on his deathbed confessed to being the one that coordinated and organized the assassination of JFK. Have you heard that?
Yeah, St. James Hunt has been fairly adamant that his father admitted his complicity in the murder. And I weave the character of E. Howard Hunt through parts of the novel, Tom, because as you begin to do some research, you begin to find that there were Watergate characters that kind of pop up not only pre-Dallas, but also with CIA involvement going all the way back to the overthrow of Guatemala in 1954. So that becomes one of the sub-themes in the story, that was the CIA involved and to what extent? I don't think there's any doubt that there was some animosity within the CIA over the fact that after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, Jack kind of took some responsibility but then decided to fire the entire upper hierarchy of the CIA, making them the scapegoats for the failure.
And
Alan Dulles lost his job as a result. So I find it to be rather interesting that just 3 years later, when President Johnson is putting together his Warren Commission, mm-hmm. he appoints Alan Dulles as one of the important members of that commission investigation.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. Wasn't he ended up being on the Warren Commission, which screams cover up? I mean, it's not really that difficult looking back on it to say, okay. I mean, isn't it true with the Bay of Pigs that Kennedy left? Not only was it failed, I mean, failed is one way to say it, but didn't he knowingly leave assets to die on the beach?
Yes. Yeah. There's actually a transcript of a very bitter radio transmission, the last one off the beach, in which the last remaining members of the invasion force are literally cursing Kennedy before their radio transmission fails, because Kennedy essentially had withdrawn air support from the invasion. He withdrew naval support, and as the invasion was going down to failure, ordered the withdrawal of the U.S. Navy back over the horizon so that there wouldn't be any further contact with the invasion force. And there was a tremendous amount of anger within the military over that act, because it was seen as a very cowardly act on the part of the president.
And when you say military, do you also mean CIA with that term?
No, CIA is going to be a little bit different, but the CIA has a very interesting role in this also, because the CIA was established in the early 1950s by President Eisenhower as a means to enable the United States to exercise some of its power worldwide without the direct involvement of our military. Their very first major job was to overthrow the government of Iran, and I cover that in the book in a little bit of detail with one of my characters. And they were so pleased with the success of that operation that it very quickly led to the overthrow of the government of Guatemala 1 year later. And as the CIA and the president began to discover, regime change became easier and easier the better they got at it. So we saw the replacement of the government in Panama, the attempted replacement of the government in Cuba, the replacement of the government in Vietnam. There's a fairly long list of adversaries of the United States that were removed from office by the actions of the CIA. And that's why I postulate that with all of that experience under their belts, it really wasn't too far-fetched to think that the CIA might have also been involved in a regime change in Washington, D.C. as well.
It makes more sense to me, Chuck, that it would be an either-or. In other words, it doesn't connect with me that it would be military, CIA, all these together. I mean, it makes a lot more sense just practically that, you know, CIA, who, you know, I've been told from very good sources, actually somebody that I know pretty well who's been on the show, who was contracted to kill overseas through the Green Beret, but he said all the work they did stateside was actually through the mafia. And so, you know, the CIA is working with the mafia here. It makes a lot more sense to me that it would be CIA and mafia as opposed to military, CIA, in this grander conspiracy.
Well, I think that, too. And as the novel shows, there was quite an interrelationship or working relationship between the mafia and the CIA. And you were referring about that relationship overseas. Well, Cuba is a very, very good example of how the mob's interest and the CIA's interest kind of worked together to try to move Castro out of Cuba once he took over. Obviously, the organized crime families were interested in regaining their casinos, which were very lucrative, in Cuba, and the CIA was interested in removing Castro and communism as a threat to the United States. So the old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, certainly holds true here. So I worked that into the plot of the novel as well to show how that relationship would have evolved and where it could have led. But the important point that I think you have to look at, too, is that when you begin to examine the forensic evidence, not only from Dallas, but also from The autopsy on President Kennedy was done in the Bethesda Naval Hospital. The CIA had no access to Bethesda. The mob had no access to Bethesda. The only people that could have changed those autopsy results and pressured the doctors into presenting some evidence that later turned out to be untrue were military. So there had to be some degree of military involvement in this.
Makes sense. I'm going to take a break. Chuck, can you hold on over the break with us? We're talking with Chuck Helpy. The book is Kennedy Must Be Killed. Who killed Kennedy? We're going to find out after the break.
The world has flipped upside down, at least as far as job satisfaction. 20 years ago, if you'd run a survey, 60% of Americans would have said they liked their work. Today, nearly 60% of Americans dislike their work. What's changed? Is it the money? No, not the money. Control? No, it's not about control either. As it happens, these restless employees say that their work is uninteresting. Uninteresting. Now, I find that interesting. This is Howard Butt, Jr. of Laity Lodge. Maybe we need more interesting work days. Or maybe if we gave 100% to our jobs, we'd get more back. Here's a challenge. This week, work as if your job mattered and see if it doesn't raise your interest in the high calling of our daily work.
For more information, visit ourdailywork.org.
Life Changing Radio believes in Christian camps. It's a truly special place where you and your church family experience renewed strength and vision as you develop a deeper relationship with the Lord and His people. It's also a place where many children, teens, and adults come to know Christ as Savior. All this in an environment that fosters God's peace, surrounded by His wondrous creation. So make it a point to go to a Christian camp this year.
This reminder brought to you by Camp Brookwoods, Monadnock Bible Conference, and Toanipi Retreat Center.
Folks, our station is now on Facebook. Every day you'll see a new post about one of the programs you hear on the station. And from time to time, we'll tell you about special station events, contests, and important links. Just put in our call letters in the search bar, WVNE. And if you've never signed up, go to our website and click on the Facebook link at the bottom of the page. And when you sign up, become a fan. And every day you'll automatically receive our program updates on your Facebook page. Go to our website, WVNE.net, and click on the Facebook tab. And when you get to our page, make sure you click on the fan button to get our updates every day.
I'm Miriam Neff with New Beginnings. Arizona is making news. Their citizens don't feel safe. Crime is rising. People are on edge. Our nation has a job to do, and it's not happening in Arizona. One task of our national government is to secure our borders. Hasn't happened in Arizona, so the state is tackling the problem. New York is in the news. A bomb-packed SUV was parked and smoking in a popular theater and restaurant area. Alert vendors and police prevented disaster by discovering and disarming the devices. Will the state of Arizona succeed? Will people party on in New York? There are no guarantees, no promised safety. But for Christ followers, a safe place awaits. Investigate heaven. Make sure it's your final destination. We'll be safe there. This transcript at widowconnection.com.
Welcome back to the show. Tom Krause here along with Chuck Helpe, the author of Kennedy Must Be Killed. That's not his view on things. It's just the title of the book, and it's a historical novel, meaning it's fiction based on historical fact. So, Chuck, Kennedy certainly had a number of enemies and a number of people that wanted him to be gone. It was described to me as a coup, someone, again, with very, very good understanding of what went on, said it was a coup, just like in other countries. It's just American people have a hard time dealing with that.
I agree with that. It was an American coup d'etat. And I think that you're exactly right, that it's very difficult for our people, in many cases, to believe that Americans could take out their own leader. But that's one of the moral questions that I kind of posit or present within the novel, whether or not a man can feel morally justified in saving the lives of millions of others by killing one man, even if that man happens to be the president of the United States.
And who would be the millions saved, theoretically, if someone's going to talk themselves into doing this, whose lives would they be saving? What would be their justification?
I think back at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I grew up about a mile from the Pentagon, so that period of time is very vivid with me, in understanding that we were literally living at ground zero during that 13-day period. And there were also very powerful men living in Texas at the time, very wealthy oil men, who knew that if missiles could reach Washington, D.C. from Cuba, they could also reach Texas. They could reach Dallas, Austin, Fort Worth. And I believe in their minds, they felt that there was as much of a threat to their way of life in Texas as there was to our way of life in Washington, New Orleans, Miami, any place within the southern arc of the United States. But those men actually had the money and the connections, the wherewithal to do something about it. And I believe that in their own minds, they may have felt that this was not only the proper thing to do, it was justified and necessary.
I was also told by this same source that the closest to the truth, media-wise, is the Oliver Stone movie.
I enjoyed the Oliver Stone movie tremendously. I I learned some great facts from it. In fact, after seeing the movie, I took a trip down to New Orleans so I could take a look at that square area in New Orleans where the various intelligence agencies were all located. And it was exactly as portrayed in the movie, the famous address where Oswald supposedly had his small office is right across the street from the U.S. Post Office, which is where the Office of Naval Intelligence was headquartered. And it's very interesting that all the pictures of that little area show the dilapidated building that the Oswald office was in. But if they had turned the camera just a few degrees to the right, you would have captured a gigantic granite United States government building. Mm. And so the camera angles were, I think, deliberately chosen to obscure the fact that that building was right in the heart of the intelligence center of Louisiana, New Orleans, and the South.
Okay, so we have and again, as it was described to me, that people overthink it, and sometimes you need to step back and say it is what it looks like. In other words, you have E. Howard Hunt confessing to coordinating this. You have a lot of motive for people to get rid of JFK. You have to believe some crazy magic bullet theory to believe in a lone assassin. You have Jack Ruby able to get access where he could shoot somebody, not even somebody, but somebody who actually just killed the president. You have a lot of clear evidence that tells you, okay, this isn't what we're being told.
And I built all of that into the arc of my novel, Tom, because I had the very same feelings, questions, anxieties, anger that this could have happened in such a blatant way, and yet the United States really still hasn't fully addressed the implications of what that truly meant. The all the evidence out of Dallas has to be subject to all kinds of questions. I think many of the listeners are familiar with CSI and all of its offshoot programs. Mm-hmm. They know how important forensic science really is in proving the innocence or guilt of a certain individual. But in the case of the Kennedy assassination, I think the readers would be absolutely horrified at the way the forensic evidence was manipulated, plundered, counterfeited, ignored,
altered,
and generally warped in such a way that it could be used to substantiate a finding that just defies credulity.
And the only people that could alter the evidence the way they did would be people in very high power.
Correct.
So, actually, I have a, I've had over the years, I've had some email correspondence with Judy, and I forget her name now, the girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Judy Baker.
Yeah, Judy Baker, who's I think still in the Netherlands, if I'm not mistaken.
Uh-huh.
And she's made it very clear that she has information, but she is to this day afraid to come to the United States and stay here.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that still feel that way, and that also is part of the story arc that I created, because there were a lot of witnesses that began to die very mysteriously after the assassination. In the course of my research, Tom, I made a number of trips down to Dallas to try to interview people and walk various sites. And I had an interesting conversation with a gentleman at one time who told me about a friend of his who was a very prominent JF Kennedy researcher who quit the field cold turkey after receiving a very veiled threat that his life was in danger if he kept pursuing this certain a line of questioning that he had been intent on. So this person not only gave up his years of research, but shut down his investigations and essentially divorced himself from the research community at large because he was so scared for his life.
How long ago was that?
Back in 1995.
Yeah, see, that's what's amazing is we're talking many, many years later, and people are still being threatened to, you know, don't tell this, don't let this out. I mean, it's still at some level trying to be protected.
Well, that was the other story arc that I covered, because Patrick McCarthy, who is the tragic hero in my book, finds himself as the gunman on the grassy knoll. He's the one that pulls the trigger for the fatal shot, thinks that he's done the patriotic thing, and then discovers shortly thereafter that he's been set up as the patsy by people that he knew and trusted as friends. I think if you look back at the time and look into the life of Lyndon Johnson, you discover a rather despicable human being. Mm-hmm. His ties to Billy Sol Estes and Bobby Baker were going to lead him into some very serious legal trouble if Celestis and Baker were convicted of their crimes, which they ultimately were. Lyndon was not only rumored to be leaving the ticket in 64, but also potentially headed to jail. And it becomes clear throughout my novel that the best way of preventing that from happening and protecting Lyndon was also to remove John as president and move him into the White House and do it so quickly that the Russians wouldn't be able to act on the power vacuum, and Johnson would be able to very quickly close the investigation down, declare Kennedy's murder solved, and then move on to the other business at hand.
So that
becomes yet another part of what I think is a very complex set of motives.
Well, and almost too many, isn't there, Chuck? I mean, it seems like almost too many, unless you believe that there was a meeting at some level of high-level people that, you know, would include the CIA, some military people, people representing Johnson, who all would say we have a common motive here and a common problem that we need to solve together. And that's where it gets a little bit hard for me to believe, as opposed to one of the people with the motive putting something together.
Tom, I think you're going to absolutely love my book because I do, I think, manage to bring all those different individuals together in such a way that's not only credible, but very interesting. One of the other underlying stories was J. Edgar Hoover, who at the time was probably the second most powerful man in the United States. There was a real clash of cultures between the morality that J. Edgar Hoover felt was necessary in a leader and the rather reckless and immoral life that John Kennedy was leading privately. I went back and studied a lot of Hoover's writings from the 1940s and 1950s, in which he really felt belief in God was paramount to our freedoms here in the United States, and he felt that a leader of men must especially be a moral man himself, that immoral acts lead to criminal acts, and a man who could not control his sexual urges was the worst kind of degenerate in the minds of the director of the FBI. So when you find John Kennedy elected president in 1961, and he's now J. Edgar Hoover's boss, and all of John Kennedy's private life would put into doubt all of the prognostications of Hoover's public life, you could certainly see there would be a massive clash of personalities or beliefs behind the scenes that could certainly turn deadly. You were talking about a meeting. There was a very interesting meeting that took place in Dallas on November 21st, Clint Murchison's house, in which it's rumored that Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, and a number of other very prominent men were present for a very somewhat mysterious meeting. Johnson came out of that closed meeting and approached his mistress, Madeline Brown, and was very excited in proclaiming to her that after tomorrow, the Kennedys would no longer be a problem for him. And she is on record, if you want to go on to Facebook or check out YouTube on the Internet, there are a couple of very interesting interviews with Madeline Brown in which she talks about that dinner meeting the night before the assassination and the implications of what it may have meant. Hoover never admitted he was in Dallas that day, but people that were servants at the dinner party reported that he was there. Nixon had been in Dallas on business, supposedly addressing a Pepsi convention, left Dallas that morning to fly back to Washington, and was asked when he arrived in Washington if he heard the president had been shot. So there was certainly potentially that meeting of the minds that you're talking about that may have occurred, and which I do cover in the plot of my novel.
Talking with Chuck Helby, the book is Kennedy Must Be Killed. It's a novel based on fact, and we're talking about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Well, we know some things we know, and again, I'll tell you a quick story. The source I keep referencing, he was a Green Beret who was trained to assassinate leaders overseas. He was given an assignment to assassinate what was termed to him as a traitor, and you know, and he was going to go ahead and do that. But then they told him it was, you know, the location was Bethesda. I think Bethesda, and you know, he said he wouldn't do it because he never did anything stateside. He would go overseas and then disappear, and his family his wife would think he was just, you know, serving. So he refused the mission. Well, years later, he was watching a historical on the History Channel, something about all the people that had died associated with the Kennedy assassination. And he sees this name, and the name's familiar to him because it was a name he was asked to assassinate. And turns out he was the guy was the only one that had the pictures or took the pictures of the autopsy that had the actual facts of what Kennedy really looked like when he came in. So this guy, this friend of mine, realized he was asked to kill that guy. He got a hold of the guy's wife, and the story kind of goes from there. And she ended up, you know, opening up and got all the, you know, the information. And come to find out, she was told that this guy killed himself. He left a suicide note, and he had killed himself. And the wife never did believe that. So you know, there's all kinds of stories like that that just add to, you know, our president was killed by someone or someone in our country.
Yeah, that suicide took place at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, as I recall. They found the gun, but they said it was just completely out of character for him to have done what they claimed that he had done. But there were other instances of something similar to that happening. I was contacted a few weeks ago by a friend of mine who grew up in Boston, and he told a very similar, somewhat chilling story of a girlfriend's father that he knew who had left the government years ago and had built a house deep in the bios of Louisiana. And he said he drove his girlfriend home, I think it was for Thanksgiving one year, to help her move back home. And while at home visiting with her and her father took him out, showed him the property, then began to tell him a story about how he had been in the military in the 1960s and had heard that Kennedy was going to be killed in Dallas as much as a month before it actually happened. Mm-hmm. And he and the men in his unit were, I think, involved with intelligence work in the South. They kind of poo-pooed it. They said, well, they hear this crazy stuff from time to time. Well, then when the assassination actually occurred, they realized that maybe they hadn't been hearing just the locker room talk, that it actually had been some of the pre-planning talk. Well, not too long after, some of those same guys began to die very mysteriously, and he said it frightened him so badly that he resigned his commission, left the government, and took a low-level position in Louisiana teaching school and built a house for his family deep in the bio where he essentially told my friend that he wanted to be able to see him coming when they came to get him. Mm. And Tom said, you know what, he didn't really know at the time what to think of this guy's confession, just kind of just didn't believe it until he started talking to me and I started telling him about my book, and then all of a sudden he began to realize this guy probably really did know ahead of time what was really going on.
We got about 50 seconds before our next break, and then we'll have 2 minutes after that, Chuck, and we'll get all the website information. But who do you think knows the truth that's still alive? Or what? Who? What, I mean, how many people do you think, or who knows what really happened?
Well, I think most of the people that know are probably dead and gone, unfortunately. I think that the files that have been stored away by the government have probably been plundered. I know that material is missing from those files. I suspect by the time those files are finally opened in 20 or 25 years, they're going to be mostly empty. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the sanitation process has already commenced and is probably over. We're just never going to be able to know. But the Kennedy Research Community has been working really hard to try to at least keep those pieces together and keep them public, so maybe someday somebody like my friend's father might come forward and say, all right,
here's what happened.
I'm afraid, but I'm finally going to tell you. Here's what I know.
All right, Chuck, hang on. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll have 2 minutes. We'll get the websites and all that. Chuck Helpy is our guest. The book is Kennedy Must Be Killed. We're coming back.
Parents of children ages 6 to 12, Monadnock Bible Conference Center is having a one-week summer kids camp with an overnight option July 5th through the 9th. It's called Launch Point, to launch kids forward in their relationship with God and others. Bro Joe Schmidt from Texas will be teaching using biblically reinforcing stories and God-focused illusion. Plus, there'll be lots of fun activities, group games, and unforgettable adventures. That's the summer kids camp at Monadnock Bible Conference Center. Visit monadnockbible.org or call 603-532-8000.
Tune in weekday afternoons at 3:30 for an intriguing program called No Compromise Radio. It's a local show known for two things, being biblical and provocative. Your host, Mike Abendroth, senior pastor of Bethlehem Bible Church, interviews interesting people, reviews books, addresses current issues, tackles controversial topics, and answers your biblical questions. No Compromise Radio, every weekday at 3:30 p.m., only here on 760 AM, WVNE, life-changing radio.
There's an African proverb that goes this way. Every morning in Africa, a gazelle wakes up. He knows he's got to run faster than the fastest lion or he's going to get killed. Every morning, a lion wakes up and he knows he's got to outrun the slowest gazelle or he's going to starve to death. It doesn't matter if you're a lion or a gazelle, when the sun comes up, you better start running. You ever feel that way? Don't. Life isn't a jungle, and the Lion of Judah is your protector. Get moving. But wait, you don't have to run. He'll go with you. I'm Steve Brown. You think about that. Hey, I'll send you my free booklet, How to Believe. Just go to youthinkaboutthat.com.
Welcome back to the show. Chuck Helpy is our guest. The book is Kennedy Must Be Killed. And fascinating, as always. I mean, this is just a fascinating subject, and people are riveted by it and probably always will be. So, Chuck, you say a group of men, high-level men, so before we get all the websites, let's be as clear as we can. Do you think it was the CIA, the military, all the above, Johnson? Who do you think is the ringleader of this thing?
I think it was people in Texas that were loyal to Johnson. I don't think Johnson was the ringleader, but I think there were people loyal to him that were determined to try to protect him. In conjunction with the organized crime ties that they had, the military ties and the intelligence ties, I think those four elements probably came together to precipitate the events of Dallas.
And without a doubt, it looks very, very likely that it was a coup d'etat and our country took out our president.
That's what I believe.
And of course, you know, Gerald Ford, before he died, I had an author to talk with him before he died, and he admitted he lied, or the Warren Commission had lied or faked evidence before he died, so he did that.
A lot of people have admitted to that. David Bellin revealed in a lecture that he gave at the University of Michigan back in the 1990s that he dreamed up the single bullet theory.
Right.
Came to him one night in a dream, and he ran to the office next day and told Arlen Specter that this is the solution to their problem in trying to rectify the issues they had with the bullet trajectories. And that's how the single bullet theory really came about.
But sounds like a
Dave
dream.
Bellin was a tax attorney. He had no background in forensic gunfire, but somehow
Let me, John, that's crazy. It sounds like a dream, and Specter should talk. But give us the websites real quick before we run.
KennedyMustBeKilled.com. There's historical background. There's a bibliography. There's a two-minute Hollywood video, and there are links to be able to order the book through Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or even take the information and take it to your local bookseller to be able to order the book.
Thanks, Chuck. Appreciate you staying the hour, and we'll talk again soon.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
All right. God
thanks
bless.
For the good time today.
That's Chuck Helpy. Kennedy Must Be Killed. We're out of time. Love Jesus. He lives you. He loves you. 23 hours from now, we'll do it again. Another edition of Engage Your World. Have a great, wonderful, bachelorly, God-centered, God-glorifying day. See you right here tomorrow.
With Tom Krause. The opinions expressed on today's program do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of this station.